Ladies and gentlemen, good day and welcome to NDA series on Insolvency and Bankruptcy Code, Recent Jurisprudence, Issues and Proposed Amendments, Part 2 conference call. As a reminder, all participant lines will be in the listen-only mode, and there will be an opportunity for you to ask questions after the presentation concludes. Should you need assistance during the conference call, please signal an operator by pressing star, then zero on your touch-tone phone. Please note that this conference is being recorded. I now hand the conference over to Mr. Vyapak Desai. Thank you, and over to you, sir.
Thanks a lot. Good afternoon, participants, and thanks again for joining this series on Insolvency Code that NDA is running since the last month. To just recapitulate for people who were part of the last teleconference and who have joined this time, and also people who have joined for the first time. So we did our first webinar on April 10th, talking about, of course, the history about how the Insolvency Code came about, what its objectives are, what it entails, and how it has performed over a period of 1 year since its implementation in December 2016. More particularly, we touched upon two or three important topics which were becoming, you know, very, very important from a perspective of the implementation of the code and some of the resolution plans which are pending before different NCLTs in India. One, we talked at length about the issue of eligibility of the bidder itself because of the Amendment 29A in the code and its implications, what new proposals are coming up for the purpose of amendment. We also talk about the implications on the guarantors vis-a-vis the Insolvency Code, more particularly from the perspective of moratorium and some of the topics related to it. So as part of the same series, today we are holding our second part of our webinar. Today we are going to touch upon three important issues. One, we are going to first touch upon the issue related to the timelines, in sense there were certain amendments late last year and early this year in relation to when can the bids be submitted, when it can be considered beyond timelines. There was a Bhushan Steel case which brought this matter in focus, and then we saw the amendments coming the early part of this year, and of course it will then affect some of the resolutions plan which we will see as we go along this year. So that's one topic that we are going to dissect a little bit. Second topic which we are going to touch upon is the proposed amendments related to the percentage vote required for approval of plans and certain decisions by the Committee of Creditors. There are a few nuances around it, so we'll touch upon that today. And the third topic that we want to discuss is this whole the concept of fair value, which has been now introduced as part of the resolution process, because earlier there was no concept of fair value. Only thing which mattered was the liquidation value as determined on the date when the company is put as part of the resolution process, or the petition is admitted when it is considered as commencement of the resolution process. There is a new concept which has come in, which is the fair value. Of course, there are matters related to it which require some amount of debate and discussions to make sure it finally achieves its purpose. So we are going to touch upon these three topics today. We'll make it interactive, so we'll keep a lot of time post some of our initial comments, and just for the purpose of the listeners, We are also going to announce the date for the third part of this webinar or this series. And at that point in time, we are going to touch upon some of the ongoing cases in detail so that we understand how things are moving in different cases at different NCLTs, how they travel to Supreme Court, so on and so forth. So with that introduction, let me also introduce my colleagues on this webinar. We have Simon Rees, who was also part of our first webinar, which we did on April 10th. She heads our M&A and private equity practice. She's based in Mumbai. And she, at the moment, is advising a lot of clients in relation to the code and the aspects around it. We also have Sahil Kanuga, who joins today. He was not able to join the first part, but fortunately, we have him today as part of today's discussions. He heads our dispute resolution practice. He's also based in our Mumbai office. And we also have a senior member from our dispute resolution practice, Arjun Gupta, who leads our initiatives on insolvency code and advisory around it. And he was also very much part of the first webinar, which we held on April 10th. So just to now kickstart the process, and maybe I'll start with Arjun. And just to, you know, get his perspective on particularly Bhushan C and maybe some other cases which brought in the focus vis-a-vis the issue related to the timelines as to, you know, when can we accept the bids, when somebody is late, and late in a sense that they cannot participate, and how to find the right balance there. So if you can give us a little background as to why this issue became so important.
Thank you, Vyapak. Good afternoon, participants. Like Vyapak said, I'm going to deal with the judgment of the NCLT in Bhushan C, Power and Steel, because like any other statute, the first 1 year of the statute's operation gives us a lot of test cases, and this case seems to have been one of those, where we are dealing with the concept of timelines for submission of bids and resolution plans and how they are to be interpreted vis-a-vis the provisions of the code, as well as how the NCLT is interpreting these timelines. So just to take you some of these dates, because they are important from the perspective of understanding how the bids had been submitted and what was the basis of the dispute in the matter. Punjab National Bank had initiated insolvency proceedings against Bhushan Power and Steel. And during the course of the insolvency proceedings, the resolution professional had published a public notice inviting expression of interest. This was done on 21st of September 2017. The public notice provided a deadline for submission of these expression of interest, or EOIs as we call it, the last date being October 6th. However, they had received an expression of interest from Liberty House on November 13th of 2017, which was after the deadline provided under the public notice. Thereafter, the committee of creditors as well as the resolution professional went through these the expression of interest that they had received from various prospective applicants, and they released a process document to these prospective applicants. The process document had provided a deadline for submission of resolution plans, which was subsequently amended, with the final deadline being of February 8th. So February 8th was the final deadline on which resolution plans were to be submitted to the resolution professional by prospective applicants. Liberty House again failed to comply with these timelines and finally submitted its resolution plan on February 20th, which was 12 days after the timeline which was provided in the process date. Therefore, what we can understand is that the Liberty House has failed to comply with the timelines on both counts for expression of interest and resolution plan. Finally, when the Committee of Creditors sat down to deliberate and consider the various resolution plans that they had received, they did not open the resolution plan provided by Liberty House, and they did not consider it. This was citing the delay which was caused by Liberty House and the fact that they could not comply with the timelines provided in the respective notices. Liberty House preferred to file an application before the NCLT, stating that this delay should not have barred the Committee of Creditors from considering their resolution plan, and that the same should have been considered along with the rest, and due deliberation should have followed on its resolution plan. So the NCLT went through some of the relevant provisions of the code, which had also gone through various amendments during the course of the CIRP proceedings of Bhushan Power, and thereafter came to a decision. Sahil will be dealing with some of these provisions.
Thank you, Arjun. So let's understand the timeline as provided for under the code. Section 12 of the code provides that the insolvency resolution process must be completed within 180 days from the date of admission of the application initiating the process. The resolution professional can file for an extension if the Committee of Creditors, by a vote of 75% or more, asks him to do so. If he files this kind of an application, the maximum extension so permitted is 90 days. This takes you up to about 270 days and not more. The resolution professional or the resolution plan is supposed to be submitted 30 days prior to the completion of this process. Now, by virtue of the amendments to Section 25, read with 39 of the regulation, the resolution plan has to be submitted as per the invitation that is issued by the resolution professional. This has led to a change in the regime or a change in the way things are to be construed. Arjun, would you like to explain how this change has affected Bhushan?
Sure. So in the present case, after NCLT went through these provisions, it noticed that the advertisement issued by the resolution professional asking for submission of expression of interest was pre-introduction of the amendments to the CIRP regulations as well as to the code. The effect of these amendments is that as of now, any resolution plan which is to be submitted in pursuance of an invitation has to be done as per the timelines provided in the invitation document. But pre-introduction of amendment, the timelines were such that a prospective resolution applicant could submit a resolution plan till the last 30 days or till the beginning of the last 30 days for completion of the CIRP proceedings, which means that if the CIRP proceedings are to be completed within 180 days, then the resolution plan can be submitted till the 150th day. In the present factual circumstances, since the resolution plan submitted by Liberty House was submitted well within this timeline, which is well within this 150 days, if the outside limit is to be calculated as 180 days, then that is why the NCLT stated that the amendments which provide a strict adherence to the timelines provided under an invitation document need not have been complied by Liberty House. And the delay which was there by Liberty House of 12 days should not have barred the Committee of Creditors from not considering the resolution plan submitted by Liberty House. Therefore, the NCLT directed the Committee of Creditors and the resolution professional to consider the resolution plan and to re-initiate the process of choosing the a resolution plan for the particular account. Now now there are certain accounts which have been following similar timelines with respect to issuance of an invitation as well as receiving bids in person of such invitations which have been released prior to the introduction of the amendment. For example, that of Binani Cement. In that case, we had Dalmia as well as Ultratech providing their respective resolution plans. However, Ultratech had revised its bid post submission of the first round of bidding with Dalmia Cement. Now, what Ultratech is contending in the process which is going on before NCLT Calcutta is that the revised bid submitted by Ultratech was also before the completion of the period within which it was still eligible to submit its resolution plan within the scope of the unamended code and the regulations, and therefore even the revised bid should be ideally considered by the COC before taking a decision on which one it actually wants to go ahead with. In this case, considering that Ultratech's bid, second bid, was higher than that of Dalmia Cement, therefore it is important to evaluate and analyze whether such a process can be entertained by the NCLT.
Yeah, so thanks Arjun and Sahil, and maybe this takes us to a very crucial point, and maybe I'll get Simone a view on this, considering she has been party to many such instances, either part of insolvency or other different laws which are similarly placed. So I think what is happening in the code is every case is bringing about an amendment. I don't know whether 30 days timeline as prescribed in the original code was good enough or sufficient to allow as many bids as it can come, so that at least one objective of the code is met, that you get the best possible plan for the purpose of resolution, or it was required to be amended to bring in some kind of a certainty that you have to submit it within the time limit as prescribed in the invitation, which means that it will become possibly a little more rigid than what it was. Maybe it will address a situation like Bhushan Steel, but may not be able to address many other situations. So, Simone, what's your view? Is it good enough? Is it meeting the objectives which is it is set out for? Or do we really need this kind of amendments, or do we need anything more? Maybe if you can give us a little idea on that.
Sure. So I think it's important to go back to the genesis of this code and the principal purpose for which it has been enacted. And if we see, the principal purpose really is insolvency resolution. Of course, the preamble does talk about that it has to be in a time-bound manner, but it also provides that it has to be for maximization of value. So therefore, while timelines are important, it has to be a means to an end, and it's not necessarily an end in itself. So if we look at, you know, how things are progressing and how timelines are being viewed, even the Supreme Court is really taking a different stance in how timelines should be interpreted. There are certain circumstances where timelines are mandatory. There are certain circumstances where timelines are directory, and it is not necessary that in every circumstance, timelines must be something that is mandatorily adhered to. Having said that, there also has to be a balance between how justice is actually delivered and how the company really needs to be resolved, or a resolution needs to be provided to a company. And therefore, there is a good balance, needs to be a good balance between the two. Now, if you look at how the amendments have evolved, let's look at the regulations today. Now, the regulations previously, Regulation 30, did provide for a maximum period within which a resolution plan could be submitted. And that took us to the very end of the resolution period, and it said 30 days prior to the end of the resolution period. Now, one may argue that that is something that is sometimes circuitous, which means that unless you have a bid in place, how does the resolution plan really or process really end? And therefore, it could be circuitous, which is why you would need some sort of finality or finite time within which parties need to participate and resolution plans must be submitted. On the other hand, you have a situation where the primary purpose of the code is obviously maximization of value. And at the end of the day, banks and financial creditors have a responsibility to ensure that these amounts are recovered, not only for the purposes of the direct loan, to fulfill the obligations of the direct contract entered into between the bank, the secured lender, and the company, but to ensure that the economy at large and the public depositors that have actually whose money has actually been used to lend are also safeguarded. So there is a larger purpose as to why this code has been enacted, and therefore it is important to ensure that maximum value needs to be looked at, if nothing else. And therefore, if you look at how this amendment is actually worded, to our mind, it's quite a clever way of ensuring that the two are really met. If you see how resolution plans have actually been submitted today, it is more of a bidding process as opposed to an auction process, which means today that even though you may have a base value or liquidation value in mind, a bidder doesn't necessarily know what another bidder may value that asset and doesn't really necessarily always have the ability to up the ante and to therefore create maximum value. Now, if you look at, you know, how our laws auction spectrum or assets of the government, it is always an auction process. The intent is always suggested that an auction process is something that derives maximum value. So therefore, how do you ensure that an auction process today is in fact built or can be built into how this code is actually written? And all of that really comes from when a resolution plan is submitted. Now, if you look at how the amendment really works, the amendment now does provide or give the ability to the IRP to A, set out timelines within which a resolution plan must be submitted. And therefore, it is within the realm of the resolution professional to determine how it would like to conduct this bid. If you look at the language, it does not preclude a resolution or an IRP from deciding that there should be, that the process can be a little bit more open, that there is time for the committee of creditors to relook at bids, and so on and so forth, so that maximum value has actually been achieved. And therefore, once an IRP takes control and ensures and wants to ensure that maximum value is actually achieved, with this amendment, you have that ability, because the language suggests that it is the IRP that has to prescribe timelines as opposed to anything specifically included within the law. Of course, you always have the overarching 180 days, you always have the overarching the overarching framework of the law, which prescribes the maximum timeline for the resolution to be achieved. But at least the way we look at the amendment, it does provide some bit of leeway to the resolution professional to achieve a mix of maybe an auction process and a bidding process, or to direct how it would like for the resolution plans to actually be submitted.
Thanks, Simon. And going a little further from here, which also connects to our next topic, which is, yes, now we have a resolution professional, yes, we have a resolution applicant, and everything is now subject to the committee of creditors approving, disapproving, taking decisions. Now, a lot of that has also been in discussions and debates, and there have been proposed amendments to that as well in the recent committee report, vis-a-vis the percentage voting from the committee of creditors. for different kind of decisions. So maybe Sahil, if you want to give us a little idea on what it is looking like now, how it will look like post the amendments, and whether, again, is this sufficient, not sufficient, or if you have any initial comments.
Sure. Thanks a lot, Deepak. The Committee of Creditors is the very heart of the corporate insolvency process. Section 21 provides that once the claims against the corporate debtor are received and collated, and the financial position of the corporate debtor is determined, the Committee of Creditors is required to be constituted by the interim resolution professional. Who comprises of the Committee of Creditors? Who goes into this body? It comprises of all financial creditors of the corporate debtor. No operational debtors are part of this committee at all. Should there be any related party to whom financial debts are owned, they are not allowed to be represented or participative or voting in this committee in any manner whatsoever. The voting share is proportionate to the extent of financial debt of such financial creditor. All decisions are taken by a vote of not less than 75% currently. That's a very, very high threshold. You have 75% threshold for any vote as of today. The proposed amendment talk of dilution of this 75%. There are two essential brackets over here. You have crucial or critical decisions, for example, approval of a resolution plan, for which the proposal is to dilute it to a 66% vote of the Committee of Creditors. You have certain routine decisions which could be argued to be day-to-day decisions, for which the threshold is considered to be a more reasonable 51%. Now, this dilution of thresholds is something that was expected and is something in line with what we have seen internationally in various other more sophisticated jurisdictions. Any other?
Sure. So I think two things as I can see which are coming out of this. One, there is no representation from a class of stakeholders other than the financial creditors. And two, even as part of financial creditors, there are no different classes which can be or possibly can be formed, because some of them may have different interests in terms of the resolution plan. And three, there is a little ambiguity around whether it is good enough for less than 75% to approve certain things, whether you really need 75%, but then do you need different classes, what more or better participation is required. And if you continue with the way the proposed amendments are, will it prejudice a certain kind of stakeholders, or will it give a disadvantage or an advantage depending upon which side you are? So maybe, Simon, this is not a new thing. We know in terms of several corporate decisions, we have thresholds of 51%, 75%, even for larger decisions like amalgamations or raising of capital, change in articles, and so on and so forth. Most of those decisions are also based on present and voting rather than just based on the value, while this code has kept that aspect out of the context, saying that, look, it should be everyone who is entitled to vote rather than just present and voting. So will this also kind of create some hurdles in meeting the objectives or timelines? And maybe if you have any other thoughts as to how this can be addressed differently or better than how it is proposed in the latest committee report.
Sure. So, Deepak, I think it's an interesting point you brought about on present and voting, because, like you rightly said, the Companies Act at least schemes of rehabilitation or arrangements between creditors and members do require two criteria to be met. One is 75% in value and 50% in number, both looked at as a present and voting concept. Now, the intent obviously is, you know, if you have to exercise a right, you have to be present and actually, you know, volunteer to exercise it as opposed to abstaining and getting the benefit of or destroying the process by abstaining from voting. On the flip side, if you see the legislations that are closer to the bankruptcy code, like the JLF framework or the SAFRESI, for instance, or do not contemplate a present and voting concept, but they do have a lower threshold of 60% of the creditors, 50% I think by number and 60% by value, where you have, you know, a different sort of context as to how to do a vote or approve a JLF scheme or a SAFRESI action. And it was both in the JLF as well as SAFRESI, the 60% was reduced from the original 75% that was built into the regulation. Now, I think a similar stance has been taken by the report by the committee today in suggesting that the threshold of 75% is a little bit too high given the number of creditors that would form part of the COC. They had two things to play with. One is, should we, you know, look at a present and voting, in which case you may have a higher threshold. On the flip side, should we lower the threshold and instead of doing a present and voting? You know, and I think the committee looked at or chose the latter, where they said, you know, let's go in with a lower threshold and not change the way the voting is actually conducted, and therefore the prescription of 60% as opposed to 75% for a large number of the decisions. Now, you know, one can argue that the 75% threshold is something that was really high, but you have to, like you rightly said, you have to look at it from the point of view that today, under the code, a secured creditor and a unsecured creditor have really the same voting power when representing before the COC. So even though a secured creditor, you know, is supposed to be superior in terms of its as a financial creditor, it has the same voting capacity as a unsecured creditor in the COC. And therefore, by reducing the threshold, one could argue that the secured creditor is a little bit more severely impacted as opposed to a unsecured creditor, especially in circumstances where the composition of creditors sways towards unsecured creditors vis-a-vis the secured creditors. So therein lies that anomaly. But you do have at least one safeguard, which is that a dissenting secured creditor must be paid liquidation value if he, prior to the financial creditors that have actually approved the scheme, approved the resolution plan. So that safeguard continues to exist. Now, you know, we can perhaps deal with what liquidation value really means in the context where maximization of value is sought to be achieved, and what you seek to achieve is fair value as opposed to liquidation value. You can sort of have that debate. But it is definitely a little bit of a concern for a secured creditor because the threshold has really decreased from 75% to 60% to pass a resolution plan. The statistics, I think, shown by or taken by the committee suggest that more often than not, the resolution plan has been approved by an overwhelming majority, as opposed to it being on the fence, or has been rejected by an overwhelming majority, as opposed to it being on the fence. So the code is still nascent, things are still new, so it's not really clear as to how this will see what the consequence of this really will be. But of course, it is definitely a little bit of a concern for secured creditor, where before, if you had 25% or more of the total financial debt in the company, you could ensure that you could monitor the progress of the company and you had a say in how the resolution plan would actually work. Whilst now, the threshold is definitely, if accepted, the threshold would definitely be far less. So I think this puts more often than not puts secured creditors in a little bit of a weak spot as opposed to before.
Thanks, Simone. And this gives rise to a couple of points which also flows into our third topic that we want to touch upon. But more importantly, two things come in focus, right? One, yes, there is no differentiation between secured and unsecured as part of the committee of creditors, COC as we call. But one important thing is there is no participation of operational creditors as part of the decision-making body. The second aspect which Simone, you also touched upon, is this whole concept of dissenting creditors getting liquidation value versus the value as determined under the plan, which typically expectedly would be lower than what possibly the plan may envisage, depending upon how the plan is getting implemented. Not only that the dissenting creditors get the liquidation value, but law or the code prescribes that even the operational creditor only gets maximum up to the liquidation value, which is determined based on the fact that if the resolution plan doesn't go through, then what would be the liquidation value of the company as it stood on the day the commencement of resolution was ordered or directed by the relevant NCLT. Now, this, of course, brought in another aspect into focus, and as always, India reacts to every case it deals with. Just to, take a little example, the whole Companies Act, possibly was revised based on the Satyam saga, if you really see how Companies Act was amended. And so some of the amendments you can relate directly with the cases which have happened in last 1 year. And we suddenly saw a new amendment in the code itself, bringing in the new concept of fair value as part of the decision-making body, which is Committee of Creditors, that not only the liquidation value, but the fair value has to be, be known to the Committee of Creditors, if not anybody else, beyond the liquidation value. So maybe, Arjun, if you can give us a little background as to where this stems out from, and take us through the factual aspect of that case and explain the law. And then, of course, we would like to have Sahil and Simone give their little comments about how this concept will evolve and how it will, possibly bring the balance which it, objectives are set out for.
Thanks, Vyapak. So just picking off from what Vyapak was saying, the code and how the code has been evolving is more or less from a practical perspective. We are going through various cases. We are going through various resolution process and resolution plans. And as a reaction to the same, after getting comments from various stakeholders, we are slowly but surely making the process more sound, and we are trying to plug the loopholes which are already there. So let me just explain what the concept of liquidation value is, how it was not working, and why the concept of fair value has been introduced. The day on which an insolvency application is admitted by the NCLT is defined as the insolvency commencement date. After a resolution professional has been appointed, he needs to further appoint a valuer to provide the liquidation value of the company as on the insolvency commencement date, which basically means that if the company was to go into liquidation on the insolvency commencement date, the estimated realizable liquidation value of the assets of the company would be computed and calculated by the valuer and provided to the resolution professional. The resolution professional in turn would pass on this value to the committee of creditors, who would then take this as a base or a foundation for the amount that they seek to recover from the company. This is definitely not binding as an amount which the committee of creditors can recover from the asset, or on a prospective resolution applicant with respect to how much he would want to bid. But this liquidation value was acting as a means of providing a kind of guidance to prospective applicants as well as the committee of creditors to understand what would be the recovery from a particular company. Now, if we take the case of Alok Industries, the total default amount for Alok Industries was 22,000 crore. However, the liquidation value which was set for Alok Industries was 4,200 crores. This is the amount which was calculated by the valuers and provided to the committee of creditors. Interestingly, the resolution plan, the sole resolution plan which was submitted in respect of this company, met this liquidation value and even passed it. A consortium of Reliance and JM Financial had provided a bid for around 5,000 odd crores, 4,950 to be exact, which was thereafter revised by an additional cash component, with the final bid being of 5,050 crores. So now this amount, although it met the liquidation value for the company, it would necessitate the lenders to take a huge haircut on the total outstanding amount due to them. And therefore, they did not accept this resolution plan proposed by the consortium. And the company was sent to liquidation. Thereafter, we have seen that various people, including operational creditors and the staff, there were around 18,000 directly and indirectly employed people of Alok Industries, have filed various applications before the relevant NCLT, saying that the company should somehow be revived and rehabilitated rather than being sent to the gallows and to be liquidated. Because the ramification of liquidating a company of the size of Alok Industries was far-reaching. The problem over here was that the amount being calculated as a base price or a reserve price, even if indicative in nature, was really, really low. And the reason for that is because it was taking into account only the value which can be recovered if the company is being sold in a piecemeal manner or on an asset-wise sale. However, in reality, what was happening was that the company was being sold as a going concern. The company as a whole was being transferred from a willing seller to a willing buyer. And this was not being reflected in the amount which was being set as the benchmark either for the COC or for prospective resolution applicants. A similar situation has been faced by Jyoti Structures as well, where the reserve price or the liquidation value which has been provided for the company does not even cover 30% of the total outstanding default which is there for Jyoti Structures. And that's why even Jyoti Structures was headed towards the same fate, which is liquidation. In this kind of a situation, it was decided that they will introduce the concept of fair value. And fair value as it stands is an estimated realizable value of the company if the entire assets of the company were to change hands from a willing seller to a willing buyer on the insolvency commencement date, which is the exact purpose of a resolution plan. The definition of resolution plan says that it is a plan which envisages the company to be bought over as a going concern. And therefore, now, if a fair value is being calculated by the valuer who is being appointed by the resolution professional, and then the same is being sent to the committee of creditors to form as a basis or a benchmark for prospective applicants and prospective bids, then the entire concept of certain members of the committee of creditors not agreeing with a prospective bid can become can be simplified. For example, in Alok Industries, even the amount which was provided by the consortium of 5,050 crores was actually accepted by 70% of the total committee of creditors by value. So they missed it by just 5%. So now the reason, which most probably is provided by certain members of the committee of creditors, is that this is too big a haircut and we don't want to accept this kind of a resolution plan. But if today we have a fair estimate of how much a company is worth on the insolvency commencement date, if it is being transferred as a going concern, and then a bid matches or surpasses that, then the entire process of a member of the committee of creditors either accepting or rejecting such a bid becomes more transparent, more accountable, and it becomes more easier to understand and deliberate.
Sure. So Arjun, I think that clarifies a lot in terms of how this came about and what it is all about. But maybe Simon, see, there are two aspects again to this issue as well. One, just because fair value is known to the committee of creditors, the code, of course, provides for confidentiality for such a fair value going beyond the committee of creditors, which means at least the bidders are not aware of it. Will it ensure that the bids that they generate would be equal or higher to fair value? And two, yes, there may be a fair value in terms of going concern, but there is a reason why the company has gone through what it has gone through, and it is, you know, being part of the resolution process. Having a fair value may possibly affect a decision of the creditors to accept something below fair value, because otherwise people will start questioning as to why would committee of creditors accept anything below fair value, and there may be something, you know, beyond what meets your eye, and that possibly may not allow a resolution plan to go through, and for few, you know, crores or few percentage less than the fair value, you will be forcing a company to go into liquidation. So what is your view? Is this just having a fair value in the minds of committee of creditors ensures the best price, or how does it affect the overall resolution plan and the process that we see in the current matters that are pending?
Sure. So I think, Vyapak, as I think we've previously alluded, sometimes the changes to our laws are a reaction to something that, to a reaction. And they have sort of, you know, unintended consequences, which go against the actual purpose of the code. Now, when we talk about maximization of value, the intent is for the maximization to be achieved through the process of resolution plans coming into the committee of creditors, and not necessarily for the committee of creditors to have their own fair value notions upfront. Now, I would assume that the intent is always to give the committee of creditors some sort of a yardstick as to how to make this determination, and to facilitate how the or some sort of homogeneous, you know, understanding of the company and the business and the value of the company, as opposed to reinventing the wheel on a consistent basis. Now, but the minute you call that fair value, you know, to accept fair value is nothing but something that, you know, a willing buyer is willing to buy and a willing seller is willing to sell. And no individual can substitute that by necessarily an opinion of what he thinks a willing seller is a willing buyer is willing to buy. So there will always be that gap in terms of an opinion of fair value as opposed to actual fair value being achieved by a willing sort of buyer. Now, there is always that gap in terms of how this has to be sort of looked at when you have a base value and somebody else that needs to match or justify why not a higher value. And I suppose the only way that you can achieve some purpose in this amendment is to ensure, A, that the that what is perceived to be fair value as required to be done under the regulations for committee for the committee of creditors is really only a yardstick. It's not really fair value as we would understand fair value to mean. It's a yardstick value, which is an opinion of two advisors to the company, an opinion and nothing else. And that yardstick is used to measure perhaps the valuations that willing and genuine buyers are willing to give for that asset. And you look at it, to maybe defend or push, buyers as to why a higher value may be desired. And if a higher value has actually been achieved or received, you look at it in terms of what that means for the company, whether there is any sort of cash to the company and its operations going forward, because if you have somebody that has given you a yardstick value and somebody else is willing to pay more, who is really in the wrong, where does the gap really lie in that context? So as long as it's really, a yardstick, used as a yardstick, hopefully it will be, it can be used as an enabling tool, but to say that this is fair market value and ensure that the creditors or committee of creditors is actually bound by this may achieve a different purpose or may be detrimental really, because like you rightly said, agreeing to a value that is less than what somebody perceives to be fair market value again becomes a question mark. And how do especially public banks or other creditors really approve such a proposal? And can somebody then, especially if you're lowering the threshold to 60%, can somebody then go ahead and challenge saying that the committee of creditors did not take into account 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 in making this determination? It should actually be and such a bid should not be accepted. So there lies in that anomaly in how this can actually be sort of mischief. Sure. Can actually arise there.
Sure. And also, as we discussed, the fair value is kept confidential only to the knowledge of the committee of creditors, which only comprises of financial creditors, while the operational creditors are not even aware of the fair value, but they are only entitled to the liquidation value. So, Sahil, is this fair from a perspective of operational creditors? Do you think operational creditors should have a bigger say? And if there is already a fair value based on the concept of going concern for a willing buyer and a willing seller, then do you think operational creditors should get a better share rather than the liquidation value, which in most occasions would be much lower than the fair value? Do you have any thoughts on this or any suggestions that the committee should consider before bringing in the new amendments?
That's a good question. Let's keep a couple of things in mind over here. I think it's fair to say, and each one of you have touched upon this, the Insolvency and Bankruptcy Code is definitely a work in progress. We are seeing it evolve pretty much every day. Is this the end of the evolution? Of course, it's going to continue to evolve. Another thing to keep in mind is there is possibly a mindset change that is required for everyone who is playing this game. The insolvency resolution process is not some sort of thrift shop or some sort of bargain basement. Price discovery is an important piece of the process, and it must be allowed and encouraged. The aim is always to minimize the haircut for the lenders and for any sort of creditors, whether it's financial or operational. The imp- inclusion of this concept of fair value will work to allow better price discovery as compared to what the regime was before its inclusion? Is it the best possible system as of now? Probably not. You might get some better ways to handle it. But as compared to just the concept of liquidation value, it's definitely a step forward. Now, as far as the Committee of Creditors is concerned, they can only consider plans that are before it. Fair value gives them a better idea of where the plans that are submitted by potential resolution applicants peg the value of the company as against the liquidation value. The Committee of Creditors has the opportunity to keep in mind the benefits for themselves, the financial creditors, as well as the operational creditors. So as far as the operational creditors are concerned, they stand on a better footing with the inclusion of this concept of fair market value. The way the code is currently pegged, they have no decision-making, they have no skin in the game as far as decision-making is concerned. That lies with the financial creditors. And for whatever reason that be the case, maybe they have a bigger piece of the skin in the game, and therefore the decision lies with them. But I think it's fair to say that the inclusion of this concept of fair value is something that will increase the quality of the insolvency resolution process as we are seeing today. Keep in mind, this is just the tip of the iceberg. You're in the first year of operation of the code. You have a long way to go, and we look forward to seeing it evolve.
Sure. So taking this question forward, and maybe Simon, your thoughts on this. As I was asking Sahil as well, that yes, it is great to know that this is the possible fair value. I don't know whether we can have a range rather than a particular value so that people can are a little more flexible in terms of looking at the range rather than a particular amount. And several different aspects can be involved in this. In fact, the new amendments allow the resolution professional to consult the Committee of Creditors to even set up the criteria for the purpose of the bidding and to resolution plan and the bidder. So there is a lot of flexibility which has already been provided to the resolution plan and the discretion of the Committee of Creditors, thinking that they will all act in the interest of the larger objective. But where are the operational creditors in this game? Are they only entitled to the liquidation value? If so, is there anything which the code needs to do a little more? And in a business environment that we are in, there may be significant operational creditors. There may not be financial creditors as significant as operational creditors, because the way the business models are moving, there is more financial assistance and financial models are coming up as part of business, where people are taking license models and franchise models and investment models, rather than there are different categories of investors, one only financial and one only business. So in that kind of scenario, when there are several different instruments and several different models, are we missing the participation of operational creditors, or are they getting, if I may use the word, unfair treatment, or this is fine for time being and we can look at this situation later?
Yeah. So Vyapak, I, you know, with respect to operational creditors and financial creditors, I think, like we say, this code has been a code to resolve more financial problems than really operational problems. And therefore, if you see largely, there are benefits granted to financial creditors as opposed to operational creditors. Now, on the one hand, you may argue that even financial creditors typically priority and, you know, powers are only given to secured creditors, like in the South Asia. But in this situation, they've expanded financial creditors to even include unsecured creditors. And you also have questions of whether now an entity who is, and the definition of an unsecured creditor also is really expanding, including someone that is, you know, benefited from a guarantee and so on and so forth. So the benefit of unsecured creditor, I mean, the definition of an unsecured creditor is also something that is expanding. Now, with respect to, I think, operational creditors, there is the question mark of whether they should be on the Committee of Creditors or not, I think has also been discussed by the Committee of Creditors, by the committee on in the latest report that we have. But the issue of practicality really comes into question, where you have so many individuals and so many sort of individuals, you know, comprising of a committee, where the ultimate objective of actually achieving maximum value in a time-bound manner may not really be achieved. And therefore, in the balance of things, even though operational creditors do not necessarily have a say in how the plan really works, in the balance of things, I think the time period and the practicality of things really outweighs operational creditors at the stage that we are at now. Maybe that will change, you know, in the future, but at the stage where we are at now, where process is still to be developed, and this is a new code already, you know, financial creditors have been expanded and people are coping with this code, maybe it is not maybe the right time to have operational creditors, you know, vote for a resolution plan. But having said that, I think what the court has tried to do is balance the needs of the operational creditor by saying that A, they have to at least be paid, they have to be paid liquidation value, and the liquidation value has to be paid in priority to the in priority and within 30 days really of the resolution plan being accepted. So they have tried to balance the interests of the operational creditors, at least giving them the first right to receive consideration or first right to receive payments. And you know, I think the report does also talk about whether this is fair or not vis-a-vis financial creditors. But I think to achieve that balance, this is what has been done. Now, pegging the value to liquidation value versus fair value seems to be a bit of an anomaly, because on the one hand, you have liquidation value, which is supposed to be the base. The intent is maximization of value, and therefore, if you see what a corporation creditor should get, should it not be pegged to what somebody is valuing the company as a whole, as opposed to pegging it to liquidation value? Now, again, you know, it's a little bit of a question mark as to why that is done, and why, you know, you wouldn't have maybe not fair value, but maybe the value at which a willing buyer is really, or the resolution applicant has actually pegged the company for, because maybe fair market value is something a little bit is an unknown right now, and it's an opinion which may or may not be realized. So therefore, you know, that may be a concern as well, but, you know, it should at least be pegged to what the resolution applicant has valued the company to. And maybe, you know, we will have that change sooner or later,
sure,
because that becomes a little bit unfair.
So that takes me to the last question, and then maybe we can open the debate to the questions from people who have participated. Is that we have touched upon two topics in last, 15, 20 minutes. One is the aspects of the percentage of voting from a perspective of value versus present and voting, and two, the aspect of dissenting creditors / the operational creditors who have obviously dissented to the resolution plan, and two, who have no say in the resolution plan. Both are only getting the liquidation value and not the fair value. While if you see some of the other provisions, let's say a takeover code or an amalgamation, where there may be dissenting shareholders or people who want to exit and not agree to the takeover by the new promoters, are at least ensure of a minimum price which is equal to the willing buyer paying, irrespective of whether they are leaving or whether they are staying on. Or even in an amalgamation or any scheme of restructuring, where dissenting creditors are not put to a disadvantage. versus from a fair value to the liquidation value. So are there any international standards or learnings that we can have from different jurisdictions where we can do these things differently, or this is the Indian way of dealing with this matter, or you think this is fine?
Honestly, I think Gavok, time will tell, because like you rightly said, what is liquidation value and what is fair value, even in the context of a secured creditor that has dissented, is again sort of a question mark. Is it, you know, basis the security interest that you have? And if it's basis the security interest that you have, is it book value? Because as we all know, book value today, especially for removable property, may be really low, while the fair market value is very high. So how do you really determine liquidation value is I don't know whether it's a science or art or just, you know, mathematical formulation, but I think time will tell. In terms of, I think, how internationally this has been done, I think there are various international methods that we may not have always sort of, taken into consideration here. The U.S. is a different way of dealing with bankruptcy. You have a, you know, a DIP concept. This is, you know, completely different. So I think, we will have to, there are European countries that do auction basis and, you know, and sort of take into consideration various other parameters. So I think, you know, to point out specifically, maybe India is a unique jurisdiction, and therefore we will have to have our own set of ways of calculating value. But I think even within the code, what is liquidation value, what is fair value, and who gets what when you dissent is still not something that is that has been really perfected.
Sure. Thanks, Simon. And maybe with that, we'll open the floor for some more questions from the participants, because at the end of the day, this is more of a series to bring in different suggestions and comments, because we are still to get our proposed amendments approved. And as part of this series, as we had announced last time, we are going to get a white paper produced to submit it to the government for the consideration, considering the kind of participation that we are getting on this webinar. In our view, that would be the best outcome of such discussions. So with that intent, if anybody has any suggestion, comments, thoughts, questions, queries, experiences, please feel free to share or in this forum, because we want to make this forum as a voice to make the insolvency regime better, rather than make it just a knowledge dissemination session. So can you open the floor for the questions?
Sure, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, we will now begin the question and answer session. Anyone who wishes to ask a question may please press star, then one on their touchtone telephone. If you wish to remove yourself from the question queue, you may press star, then two. Participants are requested to use handsets while asking a question. Ladies and gentlemen, we will wait for a moment while the question queue assembles. To ask a question, please press star, then one. The first question is from the line of Nakul Manaktala from Art Special Situations Finance. Please go ahead.
Yeah, good evening. So, yes, so, you know, based on your discussion, you know, it's clear that liquidation value or fair market value has such an important role in the whole, you know, setting the barometer for, you know, what a potential bid should be from perspective of dissenting financial creditor, you know, what they're supposed to be paid, you know, 25% or, you know, 40%, whatever. My question is, liquidation value and fair market value are so fluid in most cases, you know, wherein a decent chunk of liquidation value sometimes can be in the form of inventory or receivables, which may not actually be realized in the process of liquidation. So just, you know, just wanted your feedback on how, you know, your thoughts on the same, given the fluidity of what fair market value and liquidation value,
so,
you know, will be.
Yeah, you are right, and that's you are absolutely right, Nakul. And though the definitions of fair value and liquidation value also are very, very wide open under the code, the way they have been trying to address this concern, which is a very valid concern, is to say that there will be two registered valuers appointed to determine these values. And if there is a difference between what they determine, then an average of that value will be taken. Now, this is the only way possibly they thought that they will bring in some kind of a sanctity to it, so that one prejudice or one bias or one thought or one view doesn't take away the broader aspect of it. But,
but I think Simon, the principles of difference between liquidation value and fair value, right? It's one assumes the business on a going concern, and the other will assume the business on a stagnant basis. And therein lies the difference between the multiple that you will give an entity. Now, if you perceive that the business is something that is worth conducting, there's definitely a different multiple that you would give, or there will be a multiple that you will give the business. If you perceive that this is liquidation value, it's really scrap value in terms of, you know, what the assets, physically what the assets will really hold and what the inventory, current or fixed, will actually hold. And there is no real multiple or a DCF concept where you can discount the cash flows, the future cash flows. So I think the principle or the sort of the rainbow lies between the two, right? Where you have on the one hand, you have, or the pendulum sort of swings between the two. On the one hand, you have a stagnant value, which is the liquidation value, which is assumes no more business, and the fair value, which assumes a going concern and assumes that you will have incremental business, and therefore you can at least have a multiple to the revenue or multiple to the EBITDA, et cetera, and you can sort of establish fair market value in that concept. So it is fluid, but you know, in the context of things, perhaps is achievable with most businesses.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you. Participants who would like to ask questions may press star then one. A reminder to the participants, to ask a question, please press star, then one.
Comment. Any last comment? I'll ask that question.
Participants, to ask a question, please press star, then one.
So, if there are no questions, maybe what we can do possibly is Sahil to start with, and then maybe Simon and Arjun, if you have any last comment, particularly, are you positive about it? Is there a specific change or one change that you may want to see in either of these three topics that we discussed, or you think this is going fine?
Sure. Thanks a lot. I'm a little optimistic about what I see so far. I think with, and as I explained, I think with the inclusion of fair value, we'll see better price discovery, and we'll see that play out in the next few matters that come before the resolution plans that get put up for approval. Where I expect a little bit of problem is in the next few round of amendments or improvements or evolutions to the code and the way they integrate with the existing cases, which are possibly the largest value cases in monetary terms that are already before the courts. It's important that whenever there is an improvement or an evolution in any manner, not only do we do it on a look forward basis, but we also need to keep in mind the impact of such amendment on the matters that are already in process before the courts. It's not worth fighting over what is already before the court and the applicability of such amendments on matters that are already before the court. The integration needs to be thought out in a slightly better manner and possibly planned. That's something I would like to look at, possibly implemented better.
Arjun, any last thought, and maybe then Simon can conclude.
Thanks.
So I share the same sense of positivity and optimism as Sahil with respect to the code, how it's being implemented, how various arms of the state machinery are coming together to ensure that it's, the implementation is as smooth and as error-free as possible. What might be also done, and considering that we have already had one round of cabinet meetings to consider the recommendations of the law committee on possible amendments, considering that we have already seen quite a bit of litigation on what is the interpretation of the code, if there is maximum amount of clarity with respect to what they intend to say rather than keeping things fluid and up to the discretion of the various stakeholders, then that adds to just closing various cycles over here. So for example, when it comes to timelines for submission of claims and the ability for the resolution professional to structure an invitation in a way and manner so as to allow competitive bidding, if there is clarity on this aspect by way of some sort of an amendment to the CIRP regulations which are on the anvil already, then I think that will help possible future litigation on the legality of that kind of an invitation document or similar such situations where we are seeing where there is competitive bidding already happening with subsequent rounds constantly being put in by existing applicants, and we can have these processes get done within the envisaged timeline of 270 days.
Yeah, Simon, any last word? We are coming to the close at 5:30, and
I think we're all optimistic, definitely. And I hope, I think that the IRP is do realize that, you know, the amendments made to the CIRP regulations today do grant them an additional ability to control how bids need to be looked at and bids need to be or the process can actually be managed, and use that to the advantage to achieve the principal basis of this code and achieve maximum value.
Sure. And with the last comment, I know there is a lot of optimism around the amendments, but I think one aspect that we need to be a little careful, and with that, maybe we'll end today's session and then we'll announce the part three date very shortly, is that with the what we started with is the example of Bhushan Steel, where the court said, look, the amendment came after the advertisement was issued, and therefore the amendment doesn't apply to the advertisement. Now, where do we go from here? Whether all the amendments will only apply prospectively, again, whether we'll get into the debate of which amendment is a substantive right versus which is a procedural amendment applicable to the pending cases and not the new cases which are filed, or whether it will be only applicable to the cases which are filed after the amendments, and so on and so forth. I think, before we come up with a substantial amendment as that is expected to say that they want to overhaul the insolvency and bankruptcy code within less than 2 years of its implementation, I think it should be very crystal clear as to what kind of cases and what kind of amendments will apply to which matters. Otherwise, we would be possibly seeing another round of litigations only on the issue of applicability and not otherwise. But without making it sound very negative, I think as the mood of the panel is, yes, we'll see a lot in this space going forward, and we also are tracking this space very, very closely. So look forward to talk to each of the participants again in the near future, and we'll be announcing the date and the time very soon. So please look out for this space, and we'll shortly get together again. Thank you. Thanks for joining.
So shall we end the call?
Yes, thank you.
Sure. You're welcome, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of Nishit Desai Associates, that concludes this conference. Thank you for joining us, and you may now disconnect your lines.